Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
If you're the sort of Totally listener who's ever wondered to yourself, this Totally Football show makes for a really excellent podcast three times a week, but what if it was available in book form? Then you are in luck. The Totally Football Yearbook is the definitive chronicle of this season that's coming to its climax, and it'll look absolutely ravishing on your bookshelf or indeed in your bathroom. There's a foreword from Jamie Carragher, plus features and club-by-club season reviews, stats, quizzes and expertise from our chums at The Athletic and your Totally favourites like Daniel Storey, Rafa Honigstein, Duncan Alexander, James Horncastle and Julien Laurent. The Totally Football Yearbook is out on August the 5th and you can pre-order your copy wherever you get your books today.
Totally Football Show, today, as football rebuilds, a weekend with all the construction classics, Masons, Glazers, a bit of a hammering, and one huge arse crack at the Emirates as the Gunners plumb the depths again. We talk League Cup final, Man City all over Tottenham like Turkish restaurants, Burnley's 4-0 win at Wolves, Burnley had Wood, Wolves failed to make their tackles hard enough, and we look ahead to the midweek Euro ties, plus more quarter-final drama in the Intertotally. It's the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Hello to you, listener. Just a month left in the season. A month. Joining us today on the Totally Football Show, we've got Dom Fifield. Hello, Dom.
Hello, James. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks. You're fresh from covering midweek shenanigans. Daniel Storey's been writing about them too and not giving evil execs a free pass, eh, Daniel?
Absolutely right, James. Hello. Right.
Indeed. Hello to you. Tom Williams, who meanwhile is against giving anyone a pass, at least according to what Michael Cox and Adam Hurry were telling us. Tom, how do you respond to that? Write a reply. This relates to your kind of five-a-side football activities.
Hi, James. All I'll say on that is that Adam and Michael had what I would call an Anglo-Saxon football education, you know, sort of meat and two veg, God save the Queen, get it up to the big man and don't funny around at the back. Whereas I benefited from a slightly more enlightened football upbringing, and I learned that football could be about self-expression, about playfulness, about risk-taking, about joy. Fundamentally, you know, Adam and Michael never learned how to do a step over, a shimmy, a Rabona, and it's unfortunately made them bitter and sad.
I think that came across in their comments, actually, Tom, but I'm so glad you cleared that up. Much more on that, no doubt, to come in the weeks ahead. But this, a weekend that took place, of course, against a slightly unusual backdrop, your thousands of fans protesting and flybys and banners, etc. Adam Hill asks, what with the events of the last week leaving a very sour taste in the mouth and the likelihood that the 12 will try something like this again, could anyone actually bring themselves to watch any football this week? Well, that's a question. Or perhaps, did we all appreciate it even more because of how close we'd come to losing it?
I think we appreciated the EFL Cup final in particular for having fans of both teams back for the first time since Leicester Aston Villa, I think, in March 2020, which is an awfully long time ago. And it was nice listening to the commentary and hearing kind of up-to-date sounds and no delay and you know, the ironic cheers that you don't get with the fabricated crowd noise. So that was excellent. That was certainly, I think, the high point of the footballing weekend. And I think that is an antidote to the as were the protests, a kind of antidote to the grimness of the last week.
Yeah, I think that the most difficult games to watch last week were the Monday and Tuesday games, the Leeds-Liverpool game and the Chelsea-Brighton game, because you just found yourself thinking, what is the point of this? Like, these games have become totally meaningless, because at that time, certainly with the Liverpool game, you thought that, you know, this was, yeah, this thing was actually going to see the light of day. And as it happened, by the time that Chelsea game had finished, the whole house of cards was collapsing. But yeah, I must admit, I did find a slight bit of extra, a bit of a spring in my step looking ahead to the games this weekend, knowing that actually finishing in the top four does matter, as it always has done, and you know, and everything else does. So that was a welcome difference.
Slightly muted on the goals front, only 12 of them. We'll talk more about the kind of fallout and the winds of change that might just be twitching at the curtains of the window of the house of the football, the one that it lives in, and that. But let's start off with that League Cup final that Daniel enjoyed so much.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Ruben Diaz in there. Oh, and it's put away. Aymeric Laporte. And they have a quadruple after all. Four triumphs in a row in this competition. They are the Carabao Cup kings again.
Yep, Wembley. Sunday afternoon, where Man City did Spurs 1-0 and won their fourth straight League Cup. It's their sixth in 8 years. Daniel, you were taken by Pep's celebration.
Yeah, I just at the end, because he was laughing as he held up the four fingers and made a real point of doing it with Juan Malillo as well, who also did it, and they both kind of laughed together as they did it. I just thought, like, it obviously reminded me of Mourinho's deliberate four fingers up to say every one of these trophies counts. Now, he might just have been doing it to get, say, oh my goodness, I love the EFL Cup and we are incredibly good at winning it. But I do wonder if maybe there was a slight little nod to Mourinho as if to say, yeah, we get to do our four fingers now, and isn't it funny because you're not in a job anymore. Maybe I'm overreading to it. I really hope it was deliberate.
Well, Tom Williams tweeting, so good to see spectators back at Wembley. There's even one in goal for City. It was a remarkable match from the point of view of the number of shots and the amount of domination that City had. Michael Cox pointing out that they had to add an extra decimal place to the XG just to get Spurs in. XG for Man City was 3.5. XG for Spurs, 0.04. Ouch.
I think I actually went too early with that tweet. Had I waited another 20 minutes, I could have made a joke about the entire Spurs 11 being spectators, because in the first half, they were, you know, just couldn't get out of their own penalty area and made a bit of a fist of it in the second half. And there is that, you do get that with City, as impressive as they are. And I think this City team, the kind of football they play in this very fluid sort of 4-2-4 system, stands comparison with anything pretty much that Guardiola has achieved in his career. But every now and again they have these games where they're just absolutely battering a team and they can't make the breakthrough. It makes them vulnerable, as it was. They got the late goals through Laporte and got the victory they deserved. But yeah, a pretty astonishingly one-sided 1-0.
Dom, thank goodness Spurs got rid of that defensive manager they had.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether Jose Mourinho would have been able to nullify City in any way today, to be honest. I think that Spurs' problems and their inability to get out their own half was partly born of the fact they were effectively carrying a player, unfortunately, and Harry Kane clearly wasn't fit enough to feature. And he sort of had the alarm bells ringing when Ryan Mason was quoted pre-match saying, Harry's told me he's fit. Because we know Harry Kane tells people he's fit. But it's probably asking a bit too much for him to be. He certainly wouldn't be fully match fit, and even to be making any kind of impression on that City team, who were going to monopolise the ball for long periods. I think it was just he was dropping deeper and deeper, and he was playing as a 10. He wasn't. I know he had the number 10 on his shirt, but he was playing so far back that it really sort of nullified everything about him. And it would have been interesting had Mourinho been in charge. If he'd started with Kane, would he have had the strength and would have felt empowered enough to have actually taken him off? Because it felt as if he should have come off an awful lot. Well, he should have come off. He should have just come off, and they should have tried something completely different to try and inflict any kind of wound on City. But to be honest, it's a shame, really. But I suppose given we've sort of sat here for the last week now questioning why Tottenham Hotspur consider themselves to be a super club, I think that's probably confirmation that they're not, because they were completely outclassed by the better team. They hung on grimly. They defended well in periods, but their final was an anticlimax, and I fear their season could yet be an anticlimax as well.
I just wonder whether, with hindsight, sacking Mourinho when Spurs did might not actually prove to have been a bit of a mistake. I'm not a Mourinho sympathiser, and I've enjoyed all the Mourinho jokes as much as everyone else has since he was sacked. But, you know, this is a man with an excellent record in cup finals, you know, who is, or at least has historically been very good at setting traps for teams in one-off games, and who was brought to the club to try and win a trophy. And I think because it's Mourinho, the fact that he had that opportunity wrenched out of his hands 6 days before a final just felt quite funny. But it's just hard not to think that Spurs would have been better placed going into that game with him in the dugout rather than Ryan Mason. As bad as things had got with everything else, you know, and his relationship with the players and, you know, and everything, you wonder whether he might have had more of an idea of how to get a result in that game than Ryan Mason did. But again, the flip side of that, Ryan Mason, massive feel-good story, wonderful moment for him. And, you know, you did feel that sort of sense of unity between the players and the fans and the coach was there for the first time in a long time. So, I don't know, maybe that cancels it out.
Tom, do you think the 2,000 Tottenham fans that were at Wembley today would have given Mourinho any grief had he actually been in situ still?
I mean, he gets so much grief on social media, and you know, an awful lot of the Spurs fans who I know and who I follow on Spurs were absolutely sick to the back teeth of him and delighted to see him go. So you sort of think that yes, he probably would have done, but then again, and you know, not to insult Spurs, but they don't get to major finals all that often, so maybe that would have been enough for people to sort of swallow that, you know, swallow that animosity at least until the final whistle.
I think it would have been harder to sack him had he won the trophy, though. And I think it was going one that way.
Yeah, there is that.
There might have been other contractual clauses, etc. But City, though, the winners and so dominant. Were you surprised that Jesus and Aguero didn't come off the bench at all, given their problems finishing? Do you think that Pep was holding them back for Paris Saint-Germain in the week?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, it surprised me he didn't make a change for so long. It felt as if there was one moment where Sterling kind of dribbled through and then shot high and wide, and Pep made the kind of deliberate action to us kind of stand and applaud that. It felt as if he was almost rewarding the players that had started for their dominance and wanted to see them get the goal for that dominance without anyone else coming on and kind of almost muddying the waters, as if to say, well, we won because of the substitutions rather than because of the players that started, because they did play phenomenally well. I mean, and the goal came from Sterling doing what he seemed to do five or six times and does quite often, I think, when he's out of confidence, which is rather than dribble at goal, he almost dribbles into the penalty area and kind of waits for a foul to happen to him. This time it happened outside the area, but it was the first time that Aurier really lost his head and kind of fouled him. It's an odd one because City were completely dominant, but it didn't really answer any of the doubts we have about them. Foden was their best player, I think, because De Bruyne didn't look fully fit. He played well in the first half and then tailed off. But Sterling didn't really get that form back. Mahrez does everything, which is we know he can do. I mean, he must have the best first touch of any Premier League player. I think the way he takes down those long balls and cuts inside is that kind of iron robin light, but didn't score. And the goal came from a set piece, which ironically might really please Pep, because it's something that they've not been particularly good at and may well be the defining factor against PSG.
PSG are coming up on Wednesday, and they are in fine goal-scoring form, Tom. A 3-1 this weekend at Metz, a 5-0 against Angers midweek in the Cup. They're scoring loads of goals, and they're still in the midst of the title race. I'm not sure how you felt about Man City's chances against them prior to this weekend, if the League Cup final has changed your view at all.
I think it depends which Man City turn up. And I feel like, generally speaking, in recent weeks, they have been at their most impressive when they've played with the players and the system that they used at Wembley today. So without Aguero and without Jesus. And I think that's something that PSG might struggle with. I think the concern for City is that PSG have shown how deadly they can be against teams who play high up the pitch and leave space in behind. And that's been one of Mauricio Pochettino's real successes since he came in, is that he's really put the emphasis on that by moving Marco Verratti further up the pitch and by trying to make sure that Neymar, and in particular Kylian Mbappe, are getting onto the ball in those dangerous areas. Doesn't look like PSG are going to have any injuries. They're pretty much full strength.
I thought that there was a bit of a scare about Mbappe, who went off in the Mets game.
Yeah, no, he looks like he's going to be okay. So he scored a couple of goals against Mets, and then I think he got a bang on the thigh and went off as a precaution. But he should be okay. Marquinhos was the big injury doubt. He didn't feature against Mets, but looks like he should be fit to feature. Might not be fit enough to start. And yeah, I think PSG have got the sort of monkey off their backs that was their Champions League hoodoo in recent years. They showed that by the way they beat Barcelona, the way they beat Bayern Munich. I thought that Bayern were going to absolutely destroy them, so I'm not going to make any sort of prediction about the PSG Man City game. But I think both teams will be going into it in good form.
Interesting. All right, we'll have Julien Laurent giving us his thoughts on that game on our Euro show on Tuesday, along with Raphael Honigstein, of course, and James Horncastle and Alvaro Romeo, who will actually be joining us in this show as well very shortly. That's anyway on Tuesday, the Euro edition. Also out that day, the Totally Scottish Football Show, talking about a Rangers shock, Scottish FA Cup exit and other stuff too. The Offside Rule WSL edition is out on Tuesday. They'll be chatting on Bayern against Chelsea in the Women's Champions League and PSG Barca and all that. But out today, meanwhile, along with this, is the Totally Football League show, where they're celebrating Watford's promotion back up to the Premier League. I know we're all excited about this. Daniel, you particularly?
It'll be interesting to see if they keep their manager, because the last time they were promoted to the Premier League, they got rid of their manager before they started. But Cisco seems to have done a pretty impressive job, given that there was a lot of grumbles when he's appointed, as there always is when Watford appoint a manager, because you assume he's going to be there 5 minutes. But they're relentless in the second half of the season, having been pretty lethargic in the first months of it.
Is it worth them unpacking this time?
I've got a horrible feeling that the next few years of the Premier League are going to be promoted teams going down and relegated teams coming back up.
Yikes.
There's an unpredictability about Watford, though. I mean, they could throw a lot of money at it. Watford instantly become the main club in the Pozzo portfolio again, because they're in the Premier League, and it's in their interest to keep them in the Premier League, because there's more money coming in there than there is anywhere else in the world. But look, it'll be good to see Will Hughes back in the Premier League. He's been brilliant, I think, of late in the Watford team that have been resurgent over the last few months. And on a personal level, I'm quite looking forward to seeing how Harry the Hornet deals with Wilfred Zaha and the various on the trips to Vicarage Road. They seem to not get along quite so well. There's a weird sort of rivalry between Watford and Palace, which I've always been a bit uncomfortable with, but I think it's personified by, if you can be personified by a bee or bloke, no, by a bloke dressed up as a hornet, is that possible?
I think so. I'm looking forward to seeing, of course, the manager, if we get to see him in the Premier League, but Cisco Systems, how will they work in the top flight? We shall see. Watford celebrating, as I say, no doubt looking forward to taking on the likes of Arsenal and that next season. Let's get on to what the Gunners and the other Premier League sides who were in action got up to this weekend next.
Harry, is there any truth in the rumours that you're off to Spain in the summer?
Sorry, me no hablo inglés.
What about one of the Manchester clubs?
Well,
Harry, what about my source who says you're keen to stay at Spurs?
Can we keep the questions sensible, please?
Kane's future at Spurs remains uncertain, but you're guaranteed to get money back as a free bet if one leg of your fourfold acca lets you down. Paddy Power.
Max free bet £10, min odds 1-5 on each leg. Online exclusive, exclude shop bets and enhanced match odds. T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Premier League, intriguing weekend. for league fixtures got underway on Friday. Bernd Leno's tribute to Arsenal's best goalkeeping traditions, handing Everton a 1-0 win. Then Saturday, Liverpool caught late by Newcastle for a 1-1 draw at Anfield, while Liverpool's top four rivals Chelsea won 1-0 away at another of the Champions League place contenders, West Ham. Saturday evening, the Blades beat Brighton 1-0, and with Burnley on Sunday clocking up that whopping 4-0 win at Wolves, Brighton are now the only team still in range of Fulham in the relegation battle. There's 7 points between them. Elsewhere on Sunday, Leeds Man United was a big fat 0-0, and Villa West Brom ended 2-2, which may well have ended the Baggies' survival hopes. Monday evening, it's Palace at Leicester. Right. Hey, let's talk about the winds of change. The winds of change, as we've heard, players, supporters, even clubs beginning to flex their, in some cases, slightly dormant muscles and push back against some of the ills and issues that afflict the game. We've heard Gundogan speaking out on fixture congestion, saying, can we please also speak about the new Champions League format, more and more and more games? Is no one thinking about us players? Liam Toomey reporting that Chelsea are backtracking on their plans to raise season ticket prices in the light of the supporter backlash to the Super League business. We've had thousands of supporters in the last few days out, particularly at the Emirates, where I think there were 2,000 or 3,000, though, calling for Kroenke to move on. And interesting news that the owner of Spotify is throwing his hat in the ring. And we've also had this kind of pan-federational, at least in British terms, decision to stage a social media blackout from next Friday afternoon till Monday evening in response to the ongoing and sustained, I'm quoting from their press release here, discriminatory abuse received online by players and many others connected to football. The idea is to kind of provoke or push the companies affected, the social media companies, to actually making things more accountable. I remember when we had this conversation about Swansea having a similar initiative, you said it was a nice gesture and, you know, every little helps. This being such a concerted thing and for such a sustained period of time, feels like it might even have some economic impact, which I guess would be the big kind of driving force to any change.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, as I think it is ultimately performative, but then everything done by people who don't ultimately control the power is performative. More important than the blackout itself, I think, is the suggestion or maybe even the proof that so many different parties are working together. And if they're working together on a blackout, then you also assume, I think rightly, that they're working together to actually try and force meaningful action. And it sounds like it's not just going to be football clubs, it sounds like it's going to be other sports as well. And it really might snowball into something a bit bigger. And yes, it might affect share price, it might affect the social media platforms economically, but I think more important than that is it might force them to have the conversations and more than conversations with people that they should have done before now.
Yeah, an issue that's certainly not limited to sporting topics, but seems to be particularly concentrated there. By the way, on the subject of the protests and that and the Super League fallout, what did you make of Klopp's suggestions that supporters and media should calm down and carry on as normal because, quotation marks, nothing happened? It's always nice to have a man on Merseyside telling everyone to calm down, but it did seem very, very ill-judged.
Talking about ill-judged, yeah. he's clearly... He was uncomfortable when the Leeds supporters were screaming abuse at the team bus when it rocked up at Elland Road on that Monday night. I think he does need to look at the bigger picture on this a bit, if I'm honest. This isn't going to go away. It didn't happen, but it only didn't happen because people did get angry about it and get whipped up into a frenzy and actually got out and made their displeasure very, very obvious. I think he needs to appreciate the wounds that it opened within the relationships between his own club's ownership and his own club's supporters as well. I don't think they're frustrated with Jurgen Klopp or the players in any way. I think that they appreciate that he said what he could say on the matter. He made it very obvious he didn't approve of the Super League on that Monday night before and after the game at Leeds. But I just he has to acknowledge that this has really inflicted huge scars on the game in this country, and it's not going to be forgiven and forgotten overnight. It's going to rumble on. People are going to still be calling for sanctions for a while yet, for a long while yet, I imagine. And the fear that these six so-called self-appointed Big Six clubs could go off and do this again is going to be very real, particularly if they're ostracised from, you know, Premier League committees and committees within UEFA, the ECA, whatever, and they find that their influence has actually been damaged by their idiotic pursuit of a plan that was never going to work. So it's going to rumble on, and as manager of Liverpool Football Club, he's going to have to accept that. He's not going to be able to dictate what the media agenda is or what people are talking about on the COP and the sense of hurt that a lot of the people in this country had with those plans.
Mm. Interesting to read the comments from Alexander Čeferin in one of the Sundays that UEFA are going to be lenient towards the six English clubs because they were such an agent of the reversal of this whole policy, belatedly, but at least they were, whereas there are clubs who are still, who haven't actually withdrawn in any sense. So the project is suspended for them, but they still consider themselves to be part of it. And you've got the crazy old man in Madrid who's insisting that it's all going ahead and everyone's legally contracted. And what the measures are going to be against them, I don't know. What do you think is going to happen, you know, beyond the calls for sanctions stuff? What do you think actually in concrete terms will happen?
I mean, it's hard to say because it's so completely unprecedented. You know, UEFA, the Premier League, these organisations have never had to react to something like this before. And there is a balance to be struck between taking appropriate punitive measures, which would be supported by the vast, vast majority of fans, and not doing anything that damages the competitions that they administer. And that's what makes it so tricky, because we are dealing with the biggest clubs in the world who do have a unique draw and a unique marketing heft. I mean, fines is one potential step that can be taken, but then, you know, how do you hit clubs as rich as these with fines that will feel meaningful?
Clubs that are already a billion in debt anyway.
Well, yeah, exactly. So I don't know, but I await with interest the punishments that will eventually be meted out.
If there will be any.
Mm.
I think the other really interesting thing is that fans of those, and we'll use the English clubs as an example, but fans of those big six clubs face a bit of a kind of internal reckoning over the next few months, because there's a transfer window opening in the summer, and the manner and the kind of style of the protests in the last week have been not just against the actions of these owners, but actually attempting some sort of semi-forcible removal of them. And that would be the punishment for a kind of punishment administered by the masses rather than by the governing bodies themselves. But that, which is great, and I think that's brilliant, but if you then act excited that the owner of Spotify thinks he might like to buy your club because he might then buy the three or four players you think your club needs to get back into the Champions League, then that can only serve to undermine the kind of purity of the protest that you're initially making. And that's not really, I'm not blaming supporters for that, because they've been kind of indoctrinated to demand more and more players and to demand this kind of hungry pursuit of success. It's going to take them to, you know, it takes, for example, an Arsenal fan to say, I don't care if we never finish in the top four again if billionaire-owned clubs finish in the top four, because we don't want a billionaire owner anymore. We want to own our club ourselves, and therefore, you know, we don't care. We consider ourselves better than them and purer than them because we have something that we feel emotionally invested in. But that's a heck of a jump from where fans have been over the last decade, I think.
Mm. It is indeed. Well, Daniel Ek, the billionaire businessman and chief executive of Spotify, who tweeted on Friday night that he'd long time been an Arsenal supporter and would be interested if the current owners were willing to put the club up. They, I think, have said that they're hanging on. Man United, meantime, what's the price tag that they've had put on them by the Glazers? Is it 4 billion?
Mm. And the reality is that, you know, unless there is legislative change to allow some degree of fan ownership, then there isn't a group of very kind of good-willed billionaires waiting in the wings to pay that sort of money for a club. That just doesn't exist, I'm afraid.
Mm. Well, much as they didn't for the Glazers, I suppose, but creative banking. Anyway, returning to Klopp, he didn't have the best of Saturday afternoons, of course. are watching his side rack up the chances but concede late on to Newcastle. Well done, Newcastle, for their spirited finale to the game. Callum Wilson with that 92nd minute equaliser disallowed by VAR, but then Joe Willock popping up for the third match in a row with a goal off the bench. Huge.
Yeah, great result for Newcastle, who look like they've very belatedly turned a corner, only lost one of the last eight, I think it is, in the league. I think Anas Maxima, unsurprisingly, has made a really big impact since he's returned. But as so often with Liverpool this season, you felt it coming, and it looked like they'd got themselves off the hook after Callum Wilson's goal was ruled out. And yet within 3 minutes, they've allowed themselves to be forced back by Newcastle, by Steve Bruce's Newcastle, and concede a goal deep into stoppage time. And, you know, they should have put this game to bed by half-time. They had so many chances and were so wasteful. And it just felt like every time the ball fell to one of their forwards, and they had, you know, the new Fab Four of Salah, Mane, Firmino and Jota all on the pitch, but they were just forever snatching at chances or greedily taking shots when they were teammates in better positions. And you know, the longer the game on, the more you started to feel this, you know, this threat of Newcastle nicking something build. And so it proved. And you know, Liverpool had looked as if they were about to turn a corner. You know, they'd won, there's three wins on the bounce against Wolves, Arsenal, Villa, drew against Leeds in their previous game. But then they just sort of, you know, brought back down to earth in a way that feels very familiar. And it does just add to that sense that something has broken there this season. And I guess, you know, the question now for Liverpool fans is how long it's going to take to fix that. Is it going to be, you know, a summer break where a bit of distance from the club and from each other will do everyone good, or has some kind of rot set in that's going to be much more difficult to weed out?
Yeah, remarkable stat, Tom. At least according to BT Sport, Liverpool actually had more shots in this 1-1 draw with Newcastle than they had in their 7-0 win away at Palace.
It's almost like you have to bring that up. Is that contractually obliged?
John Sands says, is Alisson Maximin the best player outside the dirty half dozen? If so, then how long will he stay at Newcastle?
Harsh on Jack Grealish.
Yeah, Grealish, I think, and also a shout, even though he's a championship player, but I suspect next season that Emi Buendia might not be far off that, because he is also the business. And a shout too, because we might not talk about the game at length, but Matheus Pereira at West Brom, who was excellent again against Villa, and he is by far and away their best.
Right. So Maxman, though, here, a bit of a treat to watch as he kind of powered up and down. And Newcastle are powering up at the moment. They're now 9 points above the bottom three. Daniel, you want to have a go at Liverpool again, though?
No, just to say that this late goals thing is becoming a real pattern, without wanting to read out too long a list. Even since Christmas, they conceded last 10 minutes against West Brom, last 10 minutes against Burnley. They conceded three times in the last 20 minutes against City and Leicester, Man City and Leicester, that is. Last 5 minutes against Everton, last 5 minutes against Leeds. You know, that adds credence, I suppose, to the idea of a kind of fatigue, because I think they've only scored three times in the last 20 minutes over that kind of 19-game period. But I think it's more of a mental thing than a physical thing, really. I think you can just tell that, like Tom says, it looks like they need a break from each other, which is pretty much the antithesis of everything you think about Jurgen Klopp. He likes to keep everything really close to him. But for the first time, I think you are looking as if, yeah, everyone could do with a major tournament-less summer, which they're obviously not going to get.
Right. It was his comments afterwards. He was saying, the first present we got from VAR was that they scored a goal that was disallowed. Then we gave them another one. Why it happened, I don't know. We had to keep the ball in a specific way. We don't fight enough. And he said at this point, we don't deserve the top four. As it stands, they are now 4 points behind Chelsea, who are in fourth place. West Ham in fifth, a point ahead of Liverpool, with Spurs a point behind Klopp's side. All of those teams have played the same number of matches. You have got Everton, who are a couple of points behind Liverpool, but with a game in hand. So that could be interesting or not. The team, of course, who were the big winners this weekend were Chelsea, Dom. I pick up a fat 3 points there away at the London Stadium. A 1-0 win. Thomas Tuchel making six changes. And Timo Werner getting a run out. Woof.
Yeah, like a great win for Chelsea. A good goal for Timo Werner to score. He obviously there was the obligatory miss in there as well, but it was a well-taken winner.
He nailed his joke afterwards as well.
I think the second chance I have to score, but I think I have to come back slowly with one goal is enough. When I score two or twice today would be maybe too much for the beginning. No, joking. Yeah.
Gary Lineker's mention of the German sense of humour, I didn't think he nailed quite so well.
No.
But there you go. It was a much needed win because that was a significant fixture for them, and you know they've got the game against Real Madrid coming up so soon. It would have been easy to be distracted, but there is a relentlessness about this Tuchel team already. And it's a sort of defensive relentlessness, in all honesty. They stifle the life out of opponents. And they were probably benefited on Saturday, but the fact they were playing against a West Ham team that's been shorn of a lot of key players, particularly in attacking areas. That clearly has helped. But, I mean, you can't quibble with the defensive record. Is it 10 clean sheets already for Tuchel?
10-14, I think, yeah.
I mean, that's astonishing. I mean, considering how porous they were previously.
No, it's a remarkable turnaround. I mean, some people point to the fact that Frank Lampard did well in his first year and Arteta did well in his first year, and that there is a longer period that maybe Tuchel should be judged on. But this is a manager clearly within a wealth of experience that those managers didn't bring or haven't brought to their positions. Sorry, you mentioned West Ham getting shorn of players, particularly up front, but particularly at the back as well, because alongside everybody else who's gone out, and now Fabian Balbuena picking up a red card. I think everyone felt very unjustly late on in this game. Now, it's possible that red card's going to be rescinded. I don't know what you think about that on appeal. But if not, they've got... the last thing they need is another defender out of West Ham.
Yeah, I think it probably will be rescinded because it is interesting in that obviously it was looked at in slow motion. And the original, and I think still stands, the kind of guidance of VAR was that they would use the slow motion replays only to establish the point of contact, not on, let's say, boot, stud on leg, but not to kind of influence the severity of the incident. And this was a perfect example of that because it did look bad in ultra slow-mo, but that's because if you slow something down to that extent, your mind plays tricks on you and makes you believe that Balbuena had time to think about what he was doing, which when you swing your foot to kick a ball, you absolutely don't have time to do. And I think sometimes we fall in the trap of when lots of ex-players and lots of current players say, well, that shouldn't be a red and I've played the game, so I know. I think we sometimes fall in that trap a little bit too much. But in this case, there was such an overwhelming kind of majority opinion that said, that's just ridiculous. I mean, he can't do anything else other than kick the ball and therefore follow through in that incident. That, yeah, I suspect it will be withdrawn or rescinded, which doesn't make West Ham feel much better having lost with 10 men to the team that they really needed to get a point against, but should at least kind of mitigate the damage.
There was one similar to this a few seasons back when we still had supporters in the stadium and, okay, a bit of a vested interest in it. It was Mamadou Sakho was sent off for a similar challenge on a Bournemouth player. I think it might have been Smith, the fullback, who was playing for them, and he made contact with the ball. He was inside his own half near the touchline and he kicked the ball well into the Bournemouth half. So he's made proper contact with the ball and it's his follow-through that's taken out the man. And there was contact. He was sent off and was given a three-match ban, and that wasn't rescinded. That he had to sit that ban out. And this was very, very similar to that. So if this is rescinded, then something clearly has happened in terms of their interpretations of follow-throughs on players. I mean, I don't think either of them should have been sent off personally. I don't think either of them were horribly out of control. They were just clearing a football and the follow-through took the man because the man's leg was there, unfortunately.
I can't believe you're using this highly esteemed podcast, Dom, to settle scores on behalf of Crystal Palace from years ago.
There are a few more where that came from. I'm getting there.
Just quickly on West Ham, they've lost back-to-back league games for the first time since September, which isn't great timing given that they are within reach of what would be a historic Champions League qualification. But I think if you look at the absentees in that Chelsea game, no Aaron Cresswell, no Arthur Masuaku, no Declan Rice, no Mikel Antonio. That's basically the entire left flank of their team, their best midfielder, and literally their only centre forward. So for them to still be in contention, having been playing without those players the last few weeks, I think is to their credit. And when you look at West Ham's running, it's decent. Away to Burnley, home to Everton, away at Brighton, away to West Brom, home to Southampton, and they'll get some of those players back before then. So as big a blow as that is for West Ham, I think the top four is still completely on for them.
Well, run-in talk is now officially sanctioned. Isn't that right, Daniel? Chelsea's run-in, if you want to compare and contrast, they got Fulham at home, then Man City away, then Arsenal at home, then Leicester at home, then they finish off with Aston Villa. Liverpool, for what it's worth, Man United away next, Southampton at home, West Brom away, Burnley away, finish at home to Crystal Palace. So I'm not sure that West Ham's is, by any great measure, any easier than Chelsea or Liverpool, but West Ham already surprised the odds before. It's going to be a fascinating run-in, which is great because it looks like pretty much the only thing yet to be decided in this season.
They definitely are easier, James, because they're not playing anyone ranked higher than eighth in the table at the moment.
Okay.
And their two big rivals are. Obviously, well, this will come and bite me when they, you know, lose all of them. But on paper, at least, there's reason for optimism.
I think if Moyes was being brutally honest, he'd probably snap your hand off for sixth now and European football next season. Obviously, he'd love to finish in the top four, but it does feel like things are just starting to slightly creak.
All right. Well, Chelsea, anyway, are in fourth. They've also got Champions League coming up this week. They've got Real Madrid on Tuesday. I mentioned Alvaro Romeo would be joining us. And here he is on the line now for a quick heads up. Alvaro, thank you for being with us. Real Madrid for Chelsea on Tuesday. This Saturday, Real Madrid picking up their third 0-0 in their last four games. This time it was against Betis, previously at Getafe, also at Liverpool, and then everybody scores at Anfield these days, but not Real Madrid. Is there a bit of an issue there?
Well, of course there is, and there has been. I think that Real Madrid is the kind of team that relies a lot on solidity, relies a lot of on controlling the game. And then it's all about Karim Benzema scoring or not. And when he doesn't have his day, well, Real Madrid finds it difficult to get the 3 points, let alone go through in the Champions League to the next round. So I'm not too surprised about this 0-0 against Betis, considering that also Real Madrid had a couple of players missing that are very important too. And Betis are very good team that little by little they have lost all the naivety that they had at the beginning of the season, and now they are solid.
Any impact as well on Real Madrid, their state of mind, etc., of the whole Super League debacle, which is still very much ongoing there in Madrid?
Yes, it is ongoing. We all know that Florentino Pérez embarrassed himself last week. But I don't think that there was nothing of that on the pitch. I mean, Zinedine Zidane said before the game that was a president's thing. And maybe during the week that affected the players a little bit because they were getting probably many messages and they were losing the focus. But I wouldn't attribute Real Madrid's draw against Betis at home to, you know, a loss of focus because of the Super League. I would say that Real Madrid, more than anything, they are drained because they have had many players in the sidelines.
All right, well, it's a drained Real Madrid then for Chelsea on Tuesday. Would you make Tuchel's side the favourites?
No, I wouldn't, because I was commentating on Chelsea's game the other day, and I think that Chelsea is a very good team, a very good squad. The abundance of options that Thomas Tuchel has is incomparable right now, but at the same time, nobody's standing out ahead anybody else, maybe apart from Mason Mount. And Chelsea relies a lot on their three men centre backs, and I believe that Real Madrid relies a lot on their ball control. So I can expect a game that is cagey. I do believe that Real Madrid is more suited to control the game because they've got more quality in midfield, but I don't think that Chelsea is the favourite going ahead to this game, in the same way that I didn't think that Liverpool was favourite against Real Madrid.
How right you proved. However, while you're on, though, could you give us a quick word on the Europa League, which we'll see on Thursday at El Madrigal? Villarreal taking on Arsenal. Crikey, with Unai Emery up against the club that binned him. How big is this for him?
Well, this is very big for Unai Emery. I think that he left Arsenal in a way that probably he wouldn't have expected. I heard him in October talk about his new stint at Villarreal, and he was basically saying that for him, speaking the language to the players and speaking the right language to the players, a language that he knew, a native language, was key for him. So I think that at Villarreal he has found a place where he can actually communicate everything he wants. And I know that leaving Arsenal left a little bit of a bitter feeling in him, and this is very important for him, also for Villarreal, because just don't forget that Villarreal, as it stands, they are out of Europe for next season, and they are in a very similar situation to Arsenal, in the sense that if they win the Europa League, they'll be in the Champions League next season, but if they lose this tier, probably they won't be playing in European football next season.
Crikey, I mean, you'd hate to back anyone against them with his record in this competition. And also their form as well. They breezed past Salzburg, Dinamo Kiev, Dinamo Zagreb, who put Spurs out. They did them particularly strongly in the second leg of that, but they've been looking really good, essentially.
Yes, they are. And I think that one of the differences between Arsenal and Villarreal is that you can pretty much name Villarreal's starting 11. And this is very important coming into this stage of the competition. I believe that some players are stepping up. Gerard Moreno, we all know, he has scored already 26 goals in all competitions. But Samu Chukwueze, the Nigerian player, he scored a beautiful goal against Barcelona. And he's one of the breakthrough players in La Liga this season. And I do believe that, you know, Villarreal, they are better in Europe than domestically this season, to the point that I think that they have won only one league home game this season in the second half of the competition, whereas in Europe they are doing very well, and basically they have done it effortlessly, pretty much. You know, I think that the difference between Villarreal and the rest of the Spanish teams in the Europa League is that Villarreal has never been in trouble, really. So that makes them like a very trustworthy team. Whether they can actually put into practice performances like the past ones against a team like Arsenal, who has many options in attack, that is another story.
Mm, lots of players at Arsenal can score goals, including their goalkeeper, as we'll touch on in a second or two. Alvaro, look forward to speaking to you in Tuesday's edition on that and a wealth of other European stories. Alvaro Romeo, yeah, Arsenal, who've seen off Benfica, Olympiacos and Slavia Praha, who of course have put out Leicester and Rangers. It was that 1-1 in the first leg and then a whopping 4-0. Away in Prague, which was pretty impressive stuff. Not so much this Friday, though, for the Gunners when they went down 1-0 at home to Everton. Dom, did you catch this?
I saw bits of it. To be honest, I just thought that the protest pre-match was the significant event of the evening. That was admirable, and I thought that the fans making their feelings felt was superb to maintain momentum really over the course of the week and the groundswell of feeling after Super League. The team, I mean, look, it wouldn't surprise me if it had an adverse effect on the team's performance. But then Arsenal have been so inconsistent all season, you never know what you're going to get. And when they're without Lacazette, who's been playing so well, Aubameyang obviously is ill at the moment, so he's not around either. It was an opportunity for Everton, an Everton side that had rocked up in pretty abysmal form themselves, but they probably Arsenal were the right opponents for them that night, and they grounded out impressively. Arsenal's home record this season is absolutely wretched, and well, I mean, it'll be very interesting to see how they improve on that next season. I suspect a summer of spending, which could be easily attributed to Kroenke's trying to win people back over again, but it's required because they're nowhere near being a challenging force in this country at the moment.
Just to echo what Don was saying about the protests, I live right next to the Emirates and it sounded like a match day. I was out sitting in a friend's garden and you couldn't believe the amount of noise. It sounded like a stadium full of people. Still a lot of graffiti knocking, a lot of misspelt graffiti. I think that the first E in Kroenke catches people out quite a lot, but a fine sight nonetheless.
Daniel, how do you spell Kroenke?
K-R-O-E-N-K-E, Kroenke.
Right.
Very much in the style of the American spelling bee.
I was just going to say exactly like an American spelling bee.
So that was Everton's first win away to Arsenal since 1996. Not sure how much there is for Carlo Ancelotti to build on, given the way it came about with the second incredible own goal by Arsenal this week, etc. and so on. But Bernd Leno, it's curious what happens to goalkeepers when they join up with Arsenal. Or at least how much goalkeepers improve when they leave Arsenal is perhaps the way that it normally goes.
I think it's a pretty big fortnight for Mikel Arteta, given that they are playing Unai Emery in the Europa League and the kind of obvious comparisons drawn between them, or, you know, lack of contrast, should we say. And, you know, the kind of punchline of his tenure has been this kind of trust the process mantra. But that trust the process kind of indicates a general upward curve that will have bumps in the road, but not really seeing it. Since the first couple of months of the season, they've just kind of flatlined, really. You know, they are, if Everton could take a point from their game in hand, then, you know, they're 7 points off the top eight, which is remarkable, really, at just how quickly that kind of mediocrity has become normalised. And I guess he's escaped a lot of pressure because of the kind of absenteeism above him, but the idea is that managers kind of manage to rise above that and still create something reasonably special, and he's really doing that.
As for Everton, who are currently eighth, 6 points off the top four, they have that game in hand. If they win it, 3 points off the top four. Are they in that mix?
They've got a decent run in. They've still got to play Sheffield United, Villa and Wolves at home.
But they're the least consistent side in the Premier League, probably.
Yeah, they're wretched at... Well, they are reasonably consistent in that they're wretched at home and they're very good away. Their away games are against West Ham, who they probably want to play, in that if they want to finish above them, they might as well play them. And then they've got City away on the last day. But if City have won the league and potentially looking forward to a Champions League final the next weekend, maybe they play at sort of half pace, although you could argue their half pace might be too good for Everton anyway. But yeah, they do still have a chance because, as I say, Sheffield United, Villa and Wolves, you probably couldn't pick three better fixtures than that at the moment, because you've got two kind of sunbathing teams and one doomed team. So yes, I think they still can do it.
Well, we'll be hearing about how some of those teams got on this weekend, and one or two other things too, very, very shortly.
Keep listening for Jack Lang versus Benji Laniardo in the Intertotally Cup, sponsored by Paddy Power. And we apologise for any bad language you may hear.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, smart speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Happy birthday, Man United. On this day in 1902, Newton Heath became the club we all know and love as the Red Devils. After they were about to get wound up, you probably know this story, they were about to get wound up, you know, for bankruptcy, not, you know, annoyed or anything. And their captain, Harry Stafford, lost his dog, but the man who found his dog was a wealthy brewery owner who ended up taking over the club, building them a ground and changing their name and their colours on this day in 1902. On this day, well, actually in yesterday, in 2021, Man United had a 0-0 draw away at Elland Road. Not the greatest game, to quote Jamie Carragher's commentary in the 85th minute. This game's been awful. Jesus, oh my God. But 5 points for Leeds from consecutive games against Man City, Liverpool and Man United. That's kind of interesting. Has Bielsa basically changed his whole approach when Leeds play the big sides?
It feels like that. You look at Leeds' recent results, and what strikes you is how normal they are. You think about how many strange results they had in the first part of the season. There was a spell in December where they seemed to either score 5 goals or concede 5 goals in successive weeks for the best part of a month. Whereas recently, yeah, really good run against, you know, some of the bigger teams, that fantastic sort of opportunistic 2-1 win away at Man City, took a point off Liverpool, and then took a point off United. And I don't watch Leeds enough or as closely to definitively say, yes, they've changed a whole bunch of things. But your sort of general impression is that they are certainly attacking in a much less kamikaze way. They don't seem to fling men forward with quite so much abandon. They don't pick up too many clean sheets, but they do seem to be, you know, tightening up a little bit. And they really frustrated Man United. It's sort of watching it felt like 22 men just continually running into each other for 90 minutes, which is what you'll get, I suppose, when one of those teams are man-marking. And the whole game seemed to come down to this sort of running battle between Bruno Fernandes and Calvin Phillips. And on the very few occasions when Fernandes managed to evade Phillips, he wasn't able to do anything with it. And I think that's one of the reasons why Leeds were able to come away with the point.
Mm. Well, nil-nil that proved. Loads of goals before that, though, on Sunday. In Burnley's trip to Molineux, where they came away with a 4-0 win. That's their biggest top flight away win since 1965. Woof. And it also featured a hat-trick from Chris Wood. 3 goals all in the first half. And Wolves, I mean, people saying they're on the beach, but were they just blown away by this phenomenal Burnley side?
I think they've got an issue, Wolves, now. In that, I think for the first time, there's a kind of concerted, not just a suspicion, but a kind of growing feeling that things are going a little bit stale. Maybe they've got injury problems. In that, Raúl Jiménez effectively ruined their season, and Pedro Neto is brilliant, and he's now out as well, and Johnny's out for the season as well. But you just looked at the team that finished the game, and it kind of had Podence and Fabio Silva and Vitinha and Morgan Gibbs-White and Riyad Al-Nouri. And you looked at it and thought, well, there was this time when Wolves were finishing the top 7 where you could have picked 5 or 6 players out of their team and said any one of those could play for a big 6 club, partly because of the injuries, but it just doesn't feel that way anymore. And it suddenly looks like there's a little bit of work to do over there in the summer, which makes it a kind of difficult time if there is any uncertainty about Nuno. I just wonder if, like Ralf Hasenhüttl at Southampton, he's just wondering whether his reputation is being done more damage than good now. Having done the good stuff, maybe there's a. I always think with managers that the key to the best managerial careers is to make the moves at exactly the right time. And I just wonder if maybe both of those are just staying that little bit too long now, that they've suddenly got a battle on their hands to kind of take things up again.
Well, rumours this week linking him with the Tottenham job. Not sure how much substance there is in that. But meantime, in a kind of yin-yang balance of the force thing, as Leeds attack less, are Burnley now inheriting their kind of forward-thinking shy? Is that what's happening with it? Because this was fantastic stuff from the previously rather, well, dour Burnley.
I think I disagree with the description of Burnley as dour. This is how they attack all their games. And Chris Wood said this afterwards. He said, you know, our recent results have been disappointing. They'd lost 3 on the spin going into this. But he said he didn't feel that the performance had been poor. They just, you know, either had a bit of bad luck or come up against teams who are on a better day. But, you know, this is what Burnley can do to teams, because, you know what you're going to get. They do get at you. They're very direct. And, you know, Wolves really struggled with that. Willy Bolly had an awful game. Connor Cody, who is one of the best centre-backs in the Premier League, really struggled to get to grips with Chris Wood. And you saw that with the first goal, where Wood sends him one way, then the other, and then buries it bottom left. Dwight McNeil had a fantastic game. Really exciting player. A couple of assists for him. And I think it was a combination of a team low on confidence, missing key players, already on the beach, and a team still to secure their survival. You know, getting their tails up early on, and causing them trouble. But yeah, I generally enjoy watching Burnley. I don't find them a boring team to watch. I like the fact they're up and at them, and I think every now and again when things click, you see what a well-coached team they are, and you know, Wolves found that out today.
I saw Burnley come to Selhurst Park in, would have been, I'm just thinking, I think it was March time, when similar sort of scenario really, where you thought that Burnley needed the points desperately, they'd been on a poor run, Palace were feeling as though they were going, but it was in mid-February, blimey. Palace felt as if they were virtually safe getting there, and Palace were just slightly off it, and in the first 10 minutes Burnley scored twice, added a brilliant third, and were streets ahead, and the same sort of gulf between a mid-table team that's been safe for a while, as in Wolves and Palace, and this Burnley team that was scrapping for their lives. And look, it doesn't work every week with them, and they'll come up against better teams who will beat them and have beaten them, Burnley. But when they sense a vulnerability in an opponent, or that the opponent isn't quite there, they don't half exploit it. And that first half hat trick from Woods was summed it up really. They can bully teams. They can bully teams into submission if they're not quite at it.
Mm. Well, they move 9 points now above the bottom three, and it does look like being between Fulham, who weren't involved in a game this weekend, and Brighton, who lost 1-0 on Saturday night away at Sheffield United. This run-in and West Brom's 2-2 draw with Aston Villa, which came this Sunday night, a late 92nd minute Keenan Davis equaliser for Villa, just when it looked like Sam Allardyce's side were keeping their improbable escape bid alive. Where does this leave things? Are they now out of the picture? And Tom, I know you're strong on run-ins. What do you feel about Fulham's chances of catching Brighton? Is that done and dusted as well?
I don't have the running data.
I've got them right here.
But my gut instinct is that Fulham have probably left it too late.
Okay. Fulham have Chelsea away. They're home to Burnley. They're away at Saints. They're at Man United. They finish at home to Newcastle. Brighton have Leeds away. Then they're at Wolves. Then they're home to West Ham, home to Man City. They finish at Arsenal. Daniel.
They've been to Leeds, haven't they, Brighton? I'm sure they won at Leeds, didn't they?
Oh, sorry. Well, that goes to show that so my entire run-in is...
It's incredible that you know that.
This entire
season for me is just one massive morass of shapeless football that's all coagulated into one big homogenous lump.
It's the only game you can remember.
Successfully pick out a fixture that's been
arguably
incorrectly
the best
flipped.
Goal of the season they scored that day. I can't remember.
Duncan,
I can
remember any
fixture
except for when Liverpool came to Selhurst Park.
I don't know what you're talking about. That never happened.
Anyway, it's all over. That's what we're saying.
Yeah, it's over. It was officially marked as over because Sam Allardyce threw his chewing gum at the back of the dugout with such aggro that I'm surprised it didn't break a hole in the back of it, which was when Keenan Davis scored the equaliser for Villa. Mm. And it was some shoddy defending from West Brom and kind of constant delaying and allowing Davis to nip in. And yeah, Allardyce just took his chewing gum out of his mouth and hoyed it at the back of the dugout. So that is them officially done.
Mm. That was a brilliant game, that football. Arguably the best game of football of the weekend.
Really? Yeah. Would you say?
Oh, it was great fun. Really, really good. Loads of attempts. Pereira, as Daniel said earlier, was superb, absolutely superb. And West Brom hit the woodwork twice, maybe three times, and Villa had great chances. It was proper end-to-end stuff. But it's ultimately just condemned West Brom to the drop again.
Yeah, the other thing with Sheffield United beating Brighton is that something that's completely caught me off guard is that all three in the bottom three have now all won the same amount of games, which seems ridiculous given that Sheffield United were kind of sold as completely doomed and record low points totals, and Fulham were kind of rebounding and looking to survive. But there is 10 points between them because Sheffield United can't draw games. But yeah, they've all now only won 5 games.
Interesting. All right, well, there's still a chance. So we'll see what happens in the weeks to come for Fulham and, technically, West Brom. But for now, that's where we'll leave the Premier League weekend. And we'll finish off today with another contest of pure footballing knowledge at the Intertotally Cup.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
The Inter Totally Cup, sponsored by Paddy Power. Stadiums might not yet be full, but Paddy's offers are at full capacity. Get a free bet if one leg of your 4-plus fold ACCA lets you down on all football matches and markets.
T's and C's apply. 18+, begambleaware.org.
Yep, it's the Inter Totally Cup and it's the quarterfinals. Thursday, Michael Cox kind of Jedi'd his way to 4 out of 5 in a particularly fiendish set of questions to reach the semi-finals. He will be facing the winner of the Duncan Alexander against Sasha Gurionov clash, which is coming up next week. On the other side of the draw, this Thursday, we'll have the long-awaited trash-talking spectacular between Jules et Jim, that's Lawrence against Horncastle, the winner of which will take on one of today's contestants. Let's meet them.
Up first, he saw up Alvaro Romeo in the first round, but can he power on just as his beloved Hammers are stumbling? It's the big daddy, Benji Laniaro.
Benji, good to have you back with us. Described this week by Michael Cox as the Denmark 92 of Intertotally. Did you hear that?
Oh, no, I didn't, but I like it because, before my haircut, my hair was actually quite John Jensen-y. So I'm down. Let's go.
Okay. All right. Well, you made it past Alvaro in the first round, but I don't know if you've noticed the difficulty level of the questions has ramped up as we've reached the quarterfinal stage. Are you concerned at all about some of the fiendish poses that are coming your way?
Absolutely. I mean, my strategy is that I'm hoping that when you ask me the questions, that I know the answer to the questions. And then I do that more often than Jack does. And if that strategy comes to pass, then I win. So that's what I'm going for here.
Always the big thinker, Benji. I like it. You'll have chosen, or perhaps you're staying with the same charity that you had in round one. Who's it going to be, and what is your wager going to be?
It's the Whittington Hospital in North London. It's an NHS hospital that delivered my first child 12 days ago and looked after my wife. God bless him. And my bet is that there'll be an all-English Champions League final.
Crikey. Okay. Let's meet the competition.
And his opponent. There are no depths to which he will not plunge to ensure that victory is his. He is the bad boy of the Intertotally. He is Jack Lang.
Yeah, snarling, scheming Jack Lang joins us again with his dog, Muttley. All right, Jack.
Hello, you okay?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. You saw off Natalie Jedra in the first round with your mind games. What fiendish tricks have you got lined up for Benji here?
Well, I'll firstly give him my warm congratulations for the new arrival. That is heartfelt rather than an attempt to get inside his head, or is it?
Classic, absolutely classic. Typical Jack Lang.
It's a classic thing, you know, the bad boy in the competition. But away from that, the sweeter, you're like the Pepe of the Intertotally, I would say, Jack.
Yeah, socially completely fine. Never headbutted anyone in a public situation.
Right.
Teammates think I'm a model pro.
Well, it's time to get your battle head on, or whatever the equivalent phrase would be, as we head towards your questions. Let me just quickly check with you. What is your charity of choice and wager?
It's the Down Syndrome Association again, and my bet is for Gerard Moreno to score for Villarreal against Arsenal this week.
Ooh. Oh, all righty. Okay, well, a place in the semi-finals awaits for someone. Let's get questioning. Benji, you're up first. Here comes question one. When Liverpool lost 2-1 to Milan in the 2007 Champions League final, who scored Liverpool's goal?
Dirk Kuyt.
Is correct. Question two. Which name is missing from this list of the English league clubs that Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank played for? Leeds United, Chelsea, Charlton, Cardiff City, and... Which club is missing from that list? Leeds United, Chelsea, Charlton, Cardiff City, and one other.
Let's say, this is maybe because I think he's managing there. All right, Burton Albion.
Is incorrect. It's Middlesbrough. Borough.
Okay.
Question three. What do the finals of Euro 2004 and Euro 2016 have in common?
Euro 2016 was Portugal winning it. They beat France. 2004 was in Portugal. Is it that the host country lost?
In the final, you mean?
Yeah. In the final.
Yeah. No, absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. Okay. Question four. Which club did Nigel Clough take over in October 2020?
So he's gone back and forth between Burton. He's managed Burton a few times. A lot of Burton action for me on this quiz.
Yeah, a lot of Burton.
Okay, I don't know the answer to this, but who has recently fired a manager in...
Well, October 2020.
October 2020. I've just got to say Burton Albion again, don't I?
And once again, it's incorrect, Benji. It's Mansfield Town. The answer is Mansfield Town.
Ooh,
question five, then. Who won the first FA Cup final that was held back at the newly rebuilt Wembley?
Is it Burton Albion? No, that's not my answer. Okay, so the Cardiff finals, that was the Michael Owen against Arsenal final. Was that the last one at Cardiff? The one after? I'm going to guess, because they've won it quite a bit over the last little while, is it Chelsea?
Is correct, Benji. And I really enjoyed having the kind of director's commentary over your kind of your thinking there. Chelsea, who beat Man United 1-0, so with a score of 3 out of 5, Benji, how do you feel?
Yeah, magic. I thought that pretty lucky, to be honest. I've pulled a few of those out of my posterior.
Well, as you and everybody knows, you make your own luck in the Intertotally. Jack, let's see how you match up to that as we ask you your questions, starting with question one. Who scored Arsenal's goal when they lost 2-1 to Barcelona in the 2006 Champions League final? Who scored Arsenal's goal?
Sol Campbell.
Is correct, Jack. Question two. Which name is missing from this list of the English clubs Emil Heskey played for? Leicester, Wigan, Birmingham, Liverpool, Bolton, and...
Aston Villa.
Is correct. Question three, Jack. Who was sent off for France in the 1998 World Cup final?
Oh, I have no real memory of that. Anyone being sent off. Let's go for Lilian Thuram.
No, it was Marcel Desailly. So that's 2 out of 3 so far. You need one more to pull level with Benji. If you get the next two right, of course, you are in the semi-finals. Question four, then. Who was the Sheffield Wednesday manager at the start of this season? Start of the 2021 season, who was Sheffield Wednesday's manager?
I mean, I've got very little idea. Gary Monk.
It's correct, Jack. Oh. Where did that come from?
He was like the only person who came to mind. I knew he'd managed them at some point recently. Well, that's good. That's my Lindsay Hooper moment.
Well, indeed. You are now level with Benji, and this next question is crucial. Question five. Who won the first FA Cup final held at the Millennium Stadium?
Don't know. I'm going to do what Benji did and say someone who won it a lot around that time. Was it Arsenal?
It was not. It was Liverpool. It was Liverpool who beat Arsenal 2-1 in, I think, a game that Benji referenced while he was...
As the last game, so he's done me there.
So that takes us on to a tiebreaker. Closest answer wins a place in the semi-final. Fingers on the buttons then as I ask you, how many points have Manchester United gained in total since the start of the Premier League in 1992? Closest answer wins. Get yours in as soon as possible. How many points have Man United gained since the start of the Premier League in 92.
I'm allowed to use my calculator. Is that right?
Yeah, it's not a maths question. It's an estimate question, isn't it?
Mm.
Okay. Oh, that's a really great question.
How many points have Manchester United gained in total since the start of the Premier League in 1992?
What's your calculus, Benji, for that?
I thought the 75 points was... Now I'm realising I've gone too far here. But 75 points, yeah. I think my calculus is wrong.
We'll see. Benji has provided an answer of 2,175. Jack's answer is 2,500. The correct total of points that Manchester United have gained since the start of the Premier League in 1992 is 2,300. And that means that Benji Lanyardo, you are in the semi-final. Benji's doing the Bebeto celebration cradle rocking. Wow. Benji, from what I can see of your face, and it's not perfect on the Zoom call, you look stunned by that news.
Yeah. I'm just enjoying myself here, Jimbo. I feel like I'm like a non-league team.
You're Denmark 92, Benji.
I'll take it. I will take it. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, to see off, I'm a huge Jack Lang fan.
Right.
To see him off is a special moment.
Well, it disappointing for you, Jack, especially after that magical Gary Monk moment. It's not often you get to say those words together, but you surely won't be the last big name to fall at the hands of the Lanyardo Dynamite.
Yeah, congratulations to Benji. I'm signing up as member number one of the Lanyardo fan club, so I'll be roaring him on in
Fantastic.
The future games.
Well, Jack, how ironic that it should be a tiebreaker that actually saw you come undone this time.
Hoisted by my own petard, you should say.
Benji will be facing in the semi-final either James Horncastle or Julien Laurens. We'll be finding out which when the Intertotally returns on Thursday.
Congratulations, Benji Lanyardo. You're through to the semi-finals of the Intertotally Cup. And if you think Benji's bet that there'll be an all-English Champions League final is moderately sensible, you'll get odds of 2-1 at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Odds are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. And please, gamble responsibly.
Excellent. All right, then, with Daniel, Tom and Dominic, time to wrap up today's show. But is there anything else you'd like to add before we leave our listeners? Tom?
Just briefly, while we've been on air, Lyon and Lille have played out an incredible game in Ligue 1. Lyon were 2-0 up at half-time, leaving Lille fourth in the as-it-stands table, but Lille roared back in the second half to win 3-2, taking them back to the top of the standings and knocking Lyon out of the title race. I've been saying this quite consistently this season, but I'm going to say it again. Burak Yılmaz is an absolute baller and one of the best players in Europe at the moment.
Fantastic. All right, more of that on Tuesday. Daniel?
Just a shout out for a book which will have been published on the day that people probably listen to this, which is David Hartrick's book on England under Bobby Robson. It's called Silver Linings, and I was honoured to write the foreword, but more importantly, it's a brilliant, brilliant read. It's kind of a thorough examination of that time without ever resorting to sort of melodrama or hyperbole or scandal, which it could easily do. But yeah, it's a fantastic book. So yes, it's out now.
Fabulous, fabulous. Dom, anything you want to say apart from just goodbye?
No, I wish everybody a lovely week.
That's it. Very sweet of you. Great stuff. Well, listener, I second that thought, as I'm sure we all do. We're back with various podcasts throughout the week, and then we're totally on Thursday, of course. So catch up with you then. For now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of The Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on The Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.